Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com. Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
I'm Commander Shepard, and this is my favorite lorecast on the Citadel.
Welcome to the Mass Effect Lorecast, the podcast where we explore the vast lore behind the Mass Effect games. Spectres, welcome back. This is the Mass Effect Lorecast. I'm Tom. This is Sam. I'm already fumbling over my words. I don't know who I am. What is even going on? I'm on vacation next week. We're taking next week off. Things are busy for both of us. But we're back today with another planet-focused episode. We're not talking specifically Liara, but we're talking Liara-ish, right? Thessia is important to her.
Liara adjacent.
Liara adjacent. Yeah, we're going to Thessia, and we're going to find out all sorts of things about... Oh, wait. It says here that... Oh, no. The Asari are not to be credited with the advancements in Thessia. Seems like we got some hot takes going on, Sam.
Nah, a little bit. You know, it's all copacetic within the lore, but yeah. I might not be as kind to the Asari on this episode as some people might like. But yeah, we're going to be talking about Thessia. We've been talking about Liara for like 2 months.
Yeah, I know. It's like, well, on and off. We've kind of like, yes, it hasn't just been only Liara, but it's been Liara focused.
It's like Captain Crunch, oops, all crunch berries, but oops, all Liara.
Can you imagine eating just only crunch berries? I mean, as a kid, you always get the crunch berries out because they taste, and then you leave the other pieces, but... If it didn't have the other ones, I don't know that I could do that.
It's funny that you should bring that up because I actually buy Captain Crunch with the berries in it.
Yeah.
And recently I got like a box of Captain Crunch and I poured myself a bowl and I was surprised that there were no crunch berries in there at all. And then the next bowl I poured, like a week later,
oops, all crunch berries.
It was all crunch berries. This is a trigger warning for grossness, but when I went to the bathroom the next day, I was wondering why it was blue.
That's amazing.
Then it dawned on me. I was like, oh my God, that's why.
Do you think the crunchberries have more mass or they're more dense or something? So if you shake the box enough, they work their way down?
Maybe. I don't know what the hell happened, to be honest. Speaking of blue and berries, we're talking about Liara and Thessia, the home of the blueberries.
The blueberry race. All right. Yeah, everybody's going to love that analogy. All right. So where do we kick off? Where do we start with Thessia?
Right. Well, first of all, it's the Asari homeworld, but the long and short of it is that we find out, come the end of the trilogy, that the Asari are pretty advanced, but it's not really because of their own doing. And Thessia was given quite a leg up. So I think it's best to break it down with actual texts from the games. So why don't we start with the Codex a little bit?
Oh, but all they ever do is read from the Codex. Oh, no. Other response, they never quote anything from the Codex. They just make all this crap up. How do we do both at the same time? I don't know. But here, let's
part of being the media boogeyman that we are.
So.
So here, I'll read this part of the Codex entry, and then let's go through it and really dissect it and connect it to some of the other lore that we know.
Cool.
So, first of all, It's the codex says the Asari homeworld Thessia is the core of the largest economy in the planet. Now, I wanted to stop there because that's a pretty hefty claim.
The largest economy in the Milky Way.
Or I'm sorry. Yeah. What, did I say in the planet?
Said
in
planet.
The, yeah.
Right. The planet's economy is the largest in the Milky Way. Right.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. So it's a hefty claim. Largest economy in the entire galaxy. And, you know, when you start thinking about the other planets, the other space stations, like the Citadel.
Right.
I mean.
Yeah. My thoughts immediately go to the Citadel and go, okay, well, how does the Citadel compare to Thessia? Because the Citadel's freaking huge. And extremely populous and super dynamic with lots of different races doing their stuff, right? Like,
right. But maybe each race tracks its own GDP that goes through the Citadel, so they claim their own boasting numbers. You know, if I'm just thinking, if I were in the Mass Effect universe, and if I were a member of some race in the universe, then I would want to claim credit for all of the trade that my race is bringing through the Citadel.
Yeah, I guess. If you consider the Citadel an international space, then it isn't its own economy into itself so much as it's a combination of economy across multiple nations or planets or races or whatever the dividing line
right.
is. Yeah, I could see
you that. You know, maybe it has its own measure, too, because we know that people are born on the Citadel. You know, people are born there. People die there. Mm-hmm. They live their whole lives there. You know, it's... Obviously, every race came from somewhere else, but the Citadel is a massive space station, and it's like multiple cities in one.
Yeah. Well, I guess I could imagine a large enough planet with a large enough population could dwarf the Citadel enough that even if each of the cities isn't as effective or as populous as the ones as the Citadel is, as a total, it could still be more. So,
right. And it's also, you know, Thessia is also competing with other planets like Ilium here. And we saw Ilium in Mass Effect 2. It is a massive trade hub. Like, it was so evident when we went there. This place is, like, the largest trade hub that we had seen to that point. Now, we know that it's the largest trade hub of the Terminus systems. Thessia is on the end of the Ilium-Thessia trading lane. Mm-hmm. So maybe Thessia is reaping more of the benefits from that trade than Ilium is?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe,
but
or maybe
also,
maybe they're more producers, and that's more of a trade location. And because they're producing and manufacturing more, they're making a bigger cut from the trade before it goes off to, you know, get its other, you know, incremental percentage up increases as the trade continues. You know how that works,
right? Yeah. Maybe Thessia is more of a primary economy. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
But the other thing that I thought about is when you compare it with Omega. And this goes for Ilium, too, because Ilium's in the Terminus systems. When you compare it with Omega, that must be hard to compare because so many of Omega's deals are off the books.
Yeah.
So they're not really counted.
Yeah, I would imagine that Omega is not on the list of largest economies because there's no way to actually track that, at least legitimately.
Yeah, there can't be, you know, because none of those people want to get taxed. Right. And of the taxes that Arya implements, I'm sure that she doesn't want to report how much she's making.
Sure. Yeah, no, that's all off the books. Like, you don't count that in the numbers.
So at least by the books, Thessia has the galaxy's largest economy. And this is another thing where we need to keep in mind that the Codex seems to have been written from this perspective of a general issued handbook for Alliance personnel.
Right. Okay. That makes sense.
So, okay. The next part is the planet's reserves of Ezo are so vast that they affect its price galaxy wide.
Wow. So they must, I mean, that must have been a huge priority to them to either collect or refine it. Or, I mean, you know, like, you get what I'm saying.
We know it's
like, it's not like you can just dig into the ground and go, oh, I found a bunch of Ezo underneath the entire freaking planet. They must have made it a priority to get it somehow.
Even outside of the narrative explanations that we get on different planet cards, we see firsthand in Mass Effect 2 when we're trying to collect Ezo through the repetitive mining of planets that it's very rare to come across a planet with a lot of Ezo.
Right.
And so to have an amount of Ezo that is so huge that you are price controlling the entire galactic economy is staggering. That means that they must have at least 60% of the galaxy's EZO, right?
Yeah, some majority stake in it, at least. And on top of it, it seems like a very intentional political decision to make that a priority. It's almost like if you were to go back in time to the discovery of EZO by this series of races who are in this, you know, since the last reaping, that they must have made that a priority early enough that they could get in on the game before everyone else. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And we also know that, you know, Asari advanced quicker than everyone else.
Yeah.
Which is something we'll get into a little bit later. But that kind of plays into the next part I wanted to talk about, which is the fact that there's so much EZO on Thessia that also affected how Asari evolved, but not just Asari, all of the fauna, too. And there's biotically active and EZO-resistant species. That's what the Codex says. So, you know, I'd like to think that, you know, biotic fauna would be quite the challenge in an evolutionary perspective.
Yeah. So, like, oh, that's a bear. No, it's a biotic bear, and it just threw a tree at me, you know, like.
Yeah, or it could be really cute, you know. Hey, that biotic bear just got down that, like, beehive with a biotic field, and now he's right. Eating the honey.
Yeah, he loves his biotic gotten honey. They said there's this, you know, they have the organic section in the grocery store. They can have like the biotically grown good section because there's certain plants that have biotic abilities that make them more delicious or whatever.
These schnozberries are floating.
The floating schnozberries are so delicious.
Can you imagine like maybe the poisonous plants on Thessia wouldn't be like they wouldn't have adapted poison as a trait. They would have adopted biotics as a trait to avoid being eaten. So if you were eating a salad and there was something in there that shouldn't be in there, it'd be like, oh, crap, I have like a Mass Effect field in my throat right now.
Right, or I can't actually pick up this leaf because it keeps pushing my fork away.
it's affecting the mass of my fork.
Right, what? Every time I go to pick this up, it's like it's 1,000 pounds.
The amazing. Not to mention the fact that, of course, we do know Varen can be biotic. We know that from the Mass Effect Citadel DLC, I believe. Or maybe, I can't remember if it's Mass Effect 1 on Pharos or the Citadel DLC, perhaps both.
I'm sure somebody in chat will help us out with
someone this. Will yeah. know. Someone's yeah. screaming at their radio right now.
Right.
But I also was interested in the EZO-resistant species. What would that look like? What benefits would that even hold?
Well, if you have creatures that are using EZO, like the bear, to get the honey, then bees that can resist EZO manipulation can protect their honey better, right? Like, I would imagine it's something like that. But it's probably more like plant species that just don't want to be eaten. It's that same sort of, like, they're resistant to whatever might be, you know, very easily able to decimate an entire forest full of these things because they just want to consume them. I would imagine an environment with EZO resistant and active creatures and animals would be highly dynamic and changing very quickly all the time.
Which is so interesting because we know the Asari are so quick they're so slow to change mentally and socially and culturally.
Right.
And that kind of leads me to my next point, which is the Codex tells us that travel to Thessia is strictly controlled. But that smuggling remains an issue. Okay, smuggling remaining an issue on any planet, not surprising, right? But travel being strictly controlled was interesting to me because it sounds xenophobic, doesn't it?
Yes. It may also, with such a high stake in EZO and EZO being so important for the function of the galaxy and travel across the galaxy and all of that, it's almost like the planet, you could consider the planet as kind of its own vault. If you were to consider like the entire, like you can't just go into Fort Knox because there's a bunch of gold in Fort Knox, right? So therefore travel to and from Fort Knox or into and out of the building is strictly controlled. Now expand that idea across an entire planet with a majority stake in EZO, which is the most valuable thing in the entire galaxy. You're going to want to strictly control travel. Now that doesn't mean that this counters your idea. It may be both. It like They might be xenophobic and protecting their stake in the most important thing in the galaxy.
Right. Maybe the xenophobia is just a byproduct of wanting to hold on to power, you know?
Yes. Right. Right. Or even only allow those Asari who should be coming and going from the planet to have access to come and go from the planet. So, like, for example, if you're a criminal, you probably lose your ability to leave or to travel. That sort of thing, right? Because smuggling remains an issue. They want to cut down on all of this illegal usage of access to Izo.
Unless you're an Ardat Yakshi. And then in that case, you should leave. because they will send you to a monastery. So if you can leave, maybe leave. But yeah, you know, leave it to the rich and powerful people to want to keep others out.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. You know, yeah.
Like this reeks of supremacist talk.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
It, and I know our Asari lover listeners are probably like, hey, they're not that bad. But think about this. Why did they keep Prothean ruins on Thessia so secret? Why, you know, they were the first ones to discover the Citadel. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But given that they're the first ones to discover the Citadel, they were so quickly technologically advanced, they didn't want to tell anyone about their advantage from the Prothean ruins. And they also have this huge reserve of Izo where they're strictly controlling travel. Now, there could be other reasons for strictly controlling that travel. It doesn't specify in the lore, the Codex, whether it's business travel, whether it's leisure travel, whether it's both.
Yeah.
But the whole aura of this is seemingly paradoxical too, because how much we've heard Asari talk about or talk down about purebloods, are both your parents Asari?
Right.
Oh, you're right. Pureblood. I don't want to be associated with you.
Right. So you would want more diverse species traveling more easily to the planet in order to therefore make sure that they can procreate, marry, repopulate, all of that.
Maybe they're just sending others out of the planet to procreate.
Maybe. I also have to wonder, I mean, they've been around for a really, really long time. We don't really have a breakdown of like the percentage of individuals on the planet who are of each race. Like maybe they are already a diverse planet. They're still majority Asari, but simply due to that fact that they like it is in their culture to marry and procreate with other races. I would imagine that there's a very, very high concentration of multiple races on the planet. It's not just the ones who walk around looking like Asari.
Maybe, but maybe not, because we know that whenever anyone procreates with an Asari, the child is Asari. Mm-hmm. And given that Asari live 1,000-year lifespans, whereas every other race is like, far less than that besides Krogan.
Yeah.
Those people would die off much quicker, whereas the Asari are living much longer. And I imagine there's some kind of desire to control population numbers, right?
Well, this all plays into the idea that, and in the Codex, it says the travel to the planet is strictly controlled. That doesn't mean limited or ruled out necessarily, but what it could mean is that they keep tallies and numbers on who and how many from each race are able to visit throughout a certain period of time. And then maybe the doors close, or maybe they go out of their way to bring in more people of different races in order to keep it more culturally diverse. And so it's controlled in that way, not in a reductive way, but in an actually increasing sort of way. It's not clear.
We thought immigration was a hot button issue here in the United States. No, but if they were keeping a tally, or at least tracking it with some way, this would require such a massive bureaucracy, right?
Yeah, but I mean, I feel like the Asari could do that. A massive beer. Yeah, they're capable of that.
Who do you think, though, has a bigger government workforce, the Asari or the Turians? Because the Turians have that mandatory conscription for public service, at least.
Yeah, I'm sure they're competitive with each other. They're probably both extremely bureaucratic.
Can you imagine an Asari DMV? How long are those wait times? they got all the time in the world, man.
I waited 2 years at the DMV. Oh, you're lucky. It took me 3 last time I was there.
It took me 40.
Right.
I was waiting in the waiting room for 1 year to call my number. Then they said I didn't have the right documents and I'd have to schedule an appointment for next century.
Yeah. In Fallout 76, there's a whole DMV quest line where you actually have to go through like the ridiculousness of waiting for the robots to call your number and all of that stuff. Can you imagine in the next Mass Effect game, you end up on Thessia and then you have to go through bureaucracy and it's like, we'll be able to see you in the next 40 years and your Shepard or whoever your main character is human and is just like, you've got to be kidding me. Like, what?
Or waiting to see an Asari specialist like healthcare.
Right, right. Or a doc. Yeah. Going to get a doctor and you're like, you're on the wait list.
Well, it looks like we have an opening for an MRI. Let's see here. Okay, 4 years from now.
Yeah, yeah.
Nah, don't worry about it.
Yeah. This is sounding less and less like the kind of place you actually want to go to.
Yeah, if you're not Asari, which maybe that's why when we go to Thessia in Mass Effect 3, almost everyone we see is Asari. But then again, the war is going on, so hard to tell.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, this stuff is always hard to judge because if you were to say like, oh, I went to this location and most of the people were like this, well, many people live in different groups and different settings. And like, if you had visited New York City, but you only went to Chinatown, you've been like, wow, there's a lot of Asian people in New York. You know, like, well, you went to the very specific spot where all the Asian people are. So,
yeah. Yeah, or if you went to Midtown, you'd be like, wow, everyone here is pompous.
Right.
And everyone here likes $46 salads.
Right. So, yeah.
What is up with that?
Maybe there is more diversity than the little sliver we get to see.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, probably. I mean, it would have been nice to have visited Thessia, you know, before the Reapers started destroying everything, but I don't know if we ever will.
Yeah. I don't know. Well, I lost. We've been on this like tangent. I lost where we are in the notes. Where?
Oh, well, yeah. Actually, that's all I had from before the midbreak. I want to talk a little bit more about Thessia's government when we get back.
Oh, cool.
And how that kind of shapes the entire narrative of the Asari and why it's kind of a paradox as well.
Awesome. Well, we're going to go thank our patrons and I'll figure out where we are in the show notes and don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com. Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
Message coming in. Patching it through.
I am sovereign, and this
Lorecast
is mine. I like the sound of that.
All right, here we are in the middle of the show. This is where we get to thank our patrons, everybody who supports the show, everyone who leaves reviews, all of that stuff. Thank you so much for your support. And we don't have any new patrons at patreon.com/MassEffectLorecast, but we do have our Shepherd tier patrons who get shout outs every single week. Ed Boy, Kira C, Lieutenant Tosino, and William, thank you so much for your support. And to all 67 of our current patrons, thanks for being here. Thanks for you being here if you are a previous supporter and you've gone away and done other things. We appreciate any and all support. So thanks for doing that. Also, if you'd like to help us out in other ways, you can leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. We'll read out your review on a future episode of the show. You can rate the show on Spotify. You can share it with your friends. All of that stuff is super, super helpful. And I see here in the middle, I found where we are in the notes again. We've got like a fun fact. What's going on with that, Sam? Fun fact.
Right. So I was going to put a planet card, but then I was like, this episode is a planet card. So,
yes.
And we have other planets to talk about later. So I'm just going to go with a fun fact, which is that, you know, I realized when I was putting this together, that we know from the book Mass Effect Revelation. Apparently, Thessia is one of the trendsetters in galactic fashion.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Ooh, all right.
So, you know, I'm often reading through these books and I'm like, I don't have a highlighter on me. But like, I want to remember that. And like, I'll be like, oh, well, I'll type it later. And then I never do.
Yeah.
But this was one that I just happened to remember while I'm going through this. And I was like, okay, interesting. So apparently Thessia is on the cutting edge of fashion.
I guess that makes sense. You got a bunch of Asari walking around and they're all pretty, I don't know, pretty. They were designed as the hot blue alien species, right? So like,
they're blue.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's our mid-break. Let's move on with the rest of the show.
Spit it out, or are you trying to build suspense?
You're so dense, sir. Obviously, I do not know as much about human relationships as I thought.
All right, we're back. So let's talk about the governance structure. That's the way to actually say it. So couldn't they have become the most advanced and like richest in the galaxy? But I mean, they could have. I mean, they are, right? Like, that's where they are. Like we were talking about how they have like what was the actual term here? The largest economy. Is that
the largest economy in the galaxy?
Right. They have the largest. But they couldn't have done that without a governmental structure, which we were kind of alluding to earlier, that would help kind of set the stage for that, right?
Yeah, or at least without some help, you know, which I really think plays a large part in that. And we'll get into that in a bit. But first, we have to address, you know, the Asari themselves and what they've done for themselves. So, you know how we talked about how since they live long lives, they often enact progress in very slow ways. And there's no, you know, single action in governments that's ever too extreme. We talked about that back on, like, I want to say just off the top of my head, I think it was episode 7. When we were talking about the Asari?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, it's been a long
time. If I'm remembering right, I was in the middle of a move, actually. I was doing the podcast on that episode from my now fiance's family house. So we'll see if my memory's right there. But yes, that's when we were talking about this. And basically, they resemble the kind of governance that we saw in ancient Greece around the time of the Peloponnesian War. And for those who aren't familiar, that's when Athens went to war with Sparta. There were different city-states. And what I mean by that is in Thessia, there are a bunch of different city-state-like governments.
Got it.
They don't always agree, and they don't always consider themselves under the same banner. But so here, easiest way to describe this is with what the Codex tells us. Thessia is host to varying republics instead of a single government, and although each maintains a formidable military, it's notable for having long been free of internal or external wars. So, really interesting.
So it's long like a time, confederation. It's like a peaceful confederation of different city-states or republics.
Yeah, right. And we don't know, you know, how large each republic is. We don't really have the population statistics on those. We don't know how many republics, unless I'm wrong. I could be wrong on that, but I don't think we know how many republics there are. What's interesting to me is that it has been so free of war for so long, and yet each one of these republics maintains a formidable military.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. Like, you wouldn't, I mean, I guess every republic would, by its definition, need its own military just for safety reasons. Like, if everybody disarmed themselves and then one of them was like, secretly built up a military, you guys are screwed. Right.
Never seen that before.
Right. So it makes sense that everybody has some military. But yeah, I would imagine, I have to wonder here. This is where my mind goes. What is different enough for each of these groups to differentiate each from each other? For example, your analogy about the Greeks. Sparta and Athens were very, very different in lots of different ways. Different economies, different social structures, different morals and ethics. They were all Greek, but they were very different people with very different agendas and all sorts of things. I would imagine that in order to maintain a bunch of different groups, that there have to be a significant enough differences other than just they're physically in different places to keep those governments together, for people to unify around a concept or a thing. That in and of itself is usually enough to spark conflict and then therefore have warfare. So to have both at the same time seems very novel and unusual. That was a lot.
Utopic.
That was a lot of words to say. How are they all different and yet not in conflict with each other?
Right. And my only thought is that they have such an affinity for discussing and debating philosophy, and not just philosophy, but diplomacy, like the diplomatic means of deploying that. You know, we understand that in Asari culture, when you reach the matriarch stage, it's kind of like almost a public service stage of your life, mm-hmm. where you are becoming this thought leader in either culture or philosophy or religion. And we do know that Asari do have religion with multiple gods. It's a polytheistic religion where maybe historically that played more of a role in decision making and government. And maybe each one of these republics, you know, worships the different god in a different way. Right. Maybe it's polytheistic like that. We don't really know enough to say that with certainty. I'm just kind of connecting the dots here between different points of lore that we know. But again, just really interesting that they have varying republics, not chieftainships, not dictatorships, republics. So they're all kind of the same form of government.
And they're managed and run by the people. A republic would be, people would have representation in, there's different kinds of republics, but at least they all have some form of representation. So maybe that cuts down on some of the conflict, because unlike in our world where there are many republics that call themselves republics, but they're actually dictatorships, if they are legitimate republics and people don't want to go to war, and there's a culture of almost like scientific dialogue, like dialogue in the philosophical terms, in the like ancient Greek dialogue kind of term of, I posit a thing, you counter the thing with evidence, we discuss and we compare evidence, and then we make decisions. Even if we disagree at the end, we peacefully decide, okay, this is where we're moving forward, or this is the place that we got to in this dialogue. And that becomes a predominant way of managing culture and conversation, even across republics, then maybe that leads to a more peaceful kind of setting.
My other thing that I noted here is that in the Codex, it specifically says that it's notable for having long been free of internal or external wars. Long according to whom? According to humans?
Right.
Because long is a subjective perspective for time.
Right.
And when you have such vast variations on lifespans, like humans to Asari, then perhaps if you ask some Asari, how long has there been peace on Thessia, you'd get a different answer than if you ask a Salarian scholar.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. Like if the actual amount of time is 500 years, then that isn't a long time for any of them. But for a human, that would be like, wow, 500 years without conflict? That's a really long time.
Because that's amazing.
Because we don't have that in our own society. Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe there are conflicts, but maybe they just, you know, when they wrap up, everyone remembers what that conflict was like for like 800 years, 800, 900. You know, they're not going to remember when they were a baby, but, you know, that kind of thing. So they remember the cost of war longer than we do.
Right.
Maybe that's why, you know, and maybe because, you know, over a 2,000-year period, that's two lifespans. That's, you know, how many generations, if you're counting a generation as a fifth of a lifespan.
Right.
You know, so maybe that's it. But also, I mentioned that this society is kind of paradoxical, right? Because they have fast technological progress. So they're still practicing this ancient classical Mediterranean form of government. And yet they have this incredibly fast technological progress where they invented automobiles 30,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It kind of sounds like Ayn Rand's perfect dream.
Oh, God. Well, I would imagine, like, especially with Izo, with so much control of Izo, using that in new and interesting ways with technology would be kind of this endless source for them. And they have so much of it that they could test it. So it makes sense that they are of that mindset. But it is interesting that is a little bit different from the speed of the rest of the culture, right?
Yeah, and I thought that, you know, I've thought about this a lot too. If human beings lived so long, let's say that they weren't immortal, but they just lived a really long time, would we have progressed as fast as we have now? I just don't know because, we as humans, typically we don't spur innovation until the fire is right under our ass.
Right, right. And usually ideologically, we do not change until previous generations disappear, until they actually die off. That's how progress usually works for humans. Technological advancement is tied to that because we have to be okay enough with the things the technology is doing that change our culture. So there's a connection there as well. Yeah, I don't know. Here's the other thing that occurs to me, though, is that human beings, as they, and this plays into the peace thing, as we get older, we become more careful and we become more peaceful in mass. People who are younger are more likely to take risks. They're more likely to be aggressive, get into fights, do things like that. But as we get older, we tend to stray further and further away from that. Maybe because we start to feel more fragile or whatever. But I would imagine if you stick around for 1,000 years, you probably pretty quickly get past the, well, it's fun to get punched in the face phase of life because you got to continue living with a face that's been punched for a very long time. Largely,
I think that's true for human beings, but for Asari, you know, you mentioned that progress doesn't happen until the older generation has died off. I assume you also mean, or just gotten so old, they're no longer in power. You know, either one. Yeah. But for Asari, they have a different kind of view on the family and elders. They, for lack of a better term, they practice elder worship, right? Mm-hmm. All the matriarchs are the ones who everyone looks up to the most.
Right.
They hold the most influence, the most sway, the most power. And typically, older generations are more conservative, like you said.
Right.
You know, they're less prone to try new things. So that's kind of why it's just so interesting that they've advanced so quickly, which is also why I think that there is an external factor behind that that we'll get into a little bit. But I also wanted to talk about how we hear repeatedly in the lore, the Asari are renowned for their cultural and political dominance. That's taken directly from the Codex as well. And that they excel in ambassadorial ventures. Okay, could have just said diplomacy there. That was a mouthful.
Ambassadorial but, ventures.
Ambassadorial ventures. Open now.
I love dealing with the Asari. They're so good at ambassadorial ventures. Like my grandpappy.
Chester Willinghamshire.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, you're right. There is kind of this weird contradiction in those things. And the matriarchs we know seem pretty stuck in their ways, right? Like they seem pretty like, I'm solid about this. I know what I'm doing. Don't question me, period, right? Not super open-minded seeming.
Well, there's Matriarch Athida, but I think she's the black sheep. You know, Matriarch Athida is the bartender we meet in Mass Effect 2.
Yeah.
Turns out to be Liara's dad.
Yeah.
But she's the black sheep, you know. So what, you know, this talk about cultural dominance, you know, in my life, I hear like when I hear these really abstract phrases, cultural dominance, I almost always cringe because I'm like, what does that mean? What does that look like?
Right.
What is cultural dominance? You know, I hear all this talk in history, especially around the Cold War, of soft power, right? The power of Coca-Cola and blue jeans. Hell yeah. But what is cultural dominance? What does that look like? Because is Asari mass media dominating the galactic entertainment sphere? I don't know. You know, how patient are Krogan to sit through an Asari soap opera?
right. Yeah. Probably not very. Can you Solarians imagine Krogan television? Krogan television's got to be wonderful.
It's like Spike TV the time.
It's just Spike TV and pranks. People pushing each other off of things.
Getting mauled by Varen.
right. Boxing matches that go on for like a week. Because they just can take so many punches.
Yeah, it's just, honestly, Krogan entertainment would be probably barbaric to a lot of us. We'd be like, oh my God, I can't believe they showed that.
Right.
If anyone watched Scarred back in the day, hosted by Jacoby, what's his name from
I don't know
Papa
this.
Roach?
I don't know about this at all.
Well, anyway, it was a show on MTV back in the day where it would show these gruesome injuries, and then people would pretty much just like, oh, fail, laugh at him. And it was on Spike TV.
Wow.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Anyway, it's a cultural throwback. Maybe that's part of American cultural dominance. But yeah, I have this question about what is Asari cultural dominance? I mean, the political dominance, that makes sense, right? That's very easy to see. They discovered the Citadel first. So I guess it means that they got to set up the ground rules first, which is an inherent advantage on every other one to come after that.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. No, that clearly makes sense. But cultural dominance, you're right. It's a vague, it's one of those vague terms. It's one of those things that a lot of people will throw together words in order to get a reaction from the words, not to be descriptive, right?
That's exactly what I'm talking about. It's like, it's not, I wouldn't say it's prescriptive language, right? But it's not descriptive either.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so if I come up with other examples, I'll rattle them off, but none come to mind right away. But
I feel like it's a phrase to convey a feeling, not an idea.
Right, right. Or maybe even worse, a belief that isn't verified in any way, like an unfounded belief where people are, you know how people are like, oh, the so-and-sos are always like this. And it's like, well, what's your evidence? Well, one time when I was at the store, this happened. And it's like, that's...
Sure.
That's okay.
Well, the cultural dominance could follow political dominance, right? Because they have had such a long-standing hierarchy where everybody knows that they've been on the Citadel the longest. They have such political influence. They have such political power that naturally what happens first with them soon follows to other groups who might want to emulate them because they either admire them or they want to, you know, gain good graces with the Asari, politically speaking. So that would follow cultural dominance. But we don't have specific examples aside from that, you know, Thessia being a fashion trendsetter that I mentioned.
Right, right. But I mean, you also have, I mean, there's political dominance, but then there's the influence that their form of politics and culture have simply in the fact that they are a bunch of republics and they're peaceful. Other societies may look up to that and go, how did you achieve that? That is influential to what we want as well, and therefore influences them culturally and politically without being an overbearing political entity on top of them. Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah. And I don't, you know, they're not didactic as a society, and they really seem to be the perfect wielder of soft power, the Asari.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
It's winning a game on Civ on cultural, cultural victory.
Right, right. Yeah, Civ. I think that's a good example. Yeah, it's they're winning the cultural game on civilization without needing to wield military might or anything like that.
Yeah, which is also why I brought up the Coca-Cola and blue jeans. But
yeah.
Okay, so this next part is applicable for where, you know, the galaxy is by the time of Mass Effect 3. And keep in mind the decentralized government structure we just talked about. The Codex tells us that the Asari, no surprise, have a strong presence in Citadel politics and galactic policy. However, its unfocused political structure of their homeworld is something that has left the Thessians unprepared for the current conflict.
This tracks, though, because if they are a confederation, that is the main drawback of a confederation, is that they don't have an overarching government system that can pull everyone together around a focused thing. So even though they're all getting along peaceful, if only 30% of these republics agree that the Reapers are a problem, then the planet as a whole is not going to have a good effective response, because there is nobody at the top saying, no, this is the thing we're all going to do. Everyone needs to get on board.
Right. You know, the decentralized structure means that they're prone to this discourse and the arguments. But I also see it in a different way. That also would mean that they're not so easily exploitable with their vulnerabilities because they're varying republics. So they're not monolithic. Right.
Right.
And
right.
There's no one, duct on the Death Star that they can shoot a laser down and blow up the whole thing.
Right. Right.
Which is the stark opposite of what Javik tells us about the Prothean Empire. He says that the Reapers were able to find the one chink in the Empire's armor and exploit it so fast that they couldn't adapt, because the Protheans forced everyone in the Empire to conform to them and their standards.
Right. Yeah, it's neither system is perfect. Each system has its drawbacks. Absolutely. But it makes sense. It makes sense for the description that you read earlier as to why that would be an issue in the case of something like the Reapers and not being able to gather together against them. But then you turn that around and it's just, I mean, you and I have talked about this before. A corporation is not moral. It's only as moral as the people in the corporation, and specifically the leadership of the corporation. So you could take a very good organization with a very moral leader, and when that moral leader moves on and somebody else takes over the leadership, all of a sudden they become extremely immoral or prone to corruption or these kinds of things. The same thing happens for countries. Anything with a monolithic structure like you were describing, with a leader at the top, is only as effective as that leader. And if that leader gets corrupted or whatever, the whole system decays underneath them. So you're right. A confederacy has kind of an inherent defense against that, but it also cannot mobilize quickly and deal with, you know, the positive side of that either.
Right. And I'm glad you brought up mobilization, because if we're putting on our military doctrine hats, then let's answer the question. Why wouldn't this form of government for the Asari help in a Reaper invasion? So you mentioned mobilization. Yep. Mobilization would vastly suffer. Right. There's no federal government governing all of Asari's military force, right? Apparently, because that's what we hear when we hear that there's varying republics, each with their own formidable military. Now, they might listen to someone powerful like the Asari counselor, but I don't think they're required to act on the counselor's whims.
Yeah.
So when we say mobilization, it means how fast can we get these forces that might be in training over here, and how fast can we deploy them to the front line where they're needed? And with what strength will they deploy with?
Right, right. And because there are multiple republics, then you know every single one of those republics is doing the math, try to figure out, can I withhold how much and still benefit more from the other republics who are giving more? You know what I'm saying? Like, it's like, right. it's like a bunch of school children on a group project. And you're like, well, if Jimmy and Jane over there do more of the work, then I do less of the work, but I still get the same grade. I still win in the end. Right. And that is not a good situation for fighting the Reapers.
there's no centralized command over the military, apparently. And what that means is there's no, ultra giga general saying, okay, all forces go there. But what happens is let's say that you have an infantry unit on the front line fighting the Reapers, and they are in dire need of extra air support, but the battle where this is happening in that republic is all depleted of air support. So someone needs to negotiate with a adjacent republic, or, you know, a republic on the other side of the planet, and say, hey, we need air support here right now.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we can't do that because we need that air support for this, or you're going to have to make it a little bit worth our while because you're going to leave us without air support in the meantime.
Right.
While those negotiations are happening, the infantrymen are being killed.
Right, right, and because they can't respond fast enough. Yes.
Right. And that kind of thing about, you know, the debate over who can help who faster, that happens interspecies, inter-race wise in Mass Effect 3. It's a theme throughout the entire game.
Yeah. I mean, this is the very thing that Shepard is fighting, to get everyone to unify and to throw everything they possibly can and stop bickering with each other and trying to figure out who's going to come out in the end, because nobody's going to win if everybody doesn't come together. Yeah.
Right. And from an economic point of view, too, decentralized economies would stifle restructuring to a wartime economy. The United States during World War II, part of the way that it was able to completely switch on a dime like that is because we practice federalism. And we have special provisions in our laws that say during wartime, the executive branch can enact powers that otherwise it wouldn't have.
Right. Right. And that's why that exists.
Yes, so that we can respond to crises faster. But it's also a double-edged sword, right? Democracies respond slower to crises, but we give up more of our liberties, our civil rights, and things that make us a democracy during times of crisis so that we can respond faster. And that makes us more prone to the rise of dictators.
Yeah, corruption and all that stuff. Yeah, there is no perfect answer. It's just this constant rebalancing between these two extremes, which I think a lot of people have figured out, but seemingly some people haven't. So there you go. But so you keep on hinting at this idea that the Asari did not develop all of this themselves, that they had help, right? What do you mean?
Yeah, so we find out in Mass Effect 3 that this, you know how Liara often says, by the goddess. Well, we find out that this goddess that Liara mentions all the time, as well as all of the Asari gods, were actually Protheans who were intervening in the Asari's evolution, not revolution.
Right, yeah, and we've talked about this being maybe a possibility on Earth, but definitely a possibility to other locations, and here it seems absolutely confirmed, right?
Yes, so I found it to be really interesting, and we'll get into that just a second, but I noticed the curators of the wiki, by the way, God bless them, the curators of the wiki compiled together all of the Asari gods with a brief description of them, and which is nice because I that would take me a lot of game time to go back and compile all the names and what they were known for. You know, I can name a few, but I think this is probably the right time to go through the Asari gods by name. You know, maybe we can switch off. Like, the first one is Alun, who is, according to the wiki, a revered Asari physician said to have been taught medicine by Athame herself. The rings of Alun are considered holy relics and still held in enough regard to inspire modern Asari to acts of compassion and healing. Now, I remember we learned about this one from a Mass Effect 3 war asset. It's something that you pick up from going around in the Normandy, and you find it on a planet.
Right. So this one references Athame.
Alun is the name of the god.
Alun, yeah. But Alun was taught medicine by Athame. It references Athame. Yes. So who's Athame?
So Athame is the goddess of prophecy and fate. If you remember in Mass Effect 3, we go to the temple of Athame, and she is highly revered. Mm. It's not entirely clear on what level of the hierarchy of gods that she is, but given that there's so many other gods who are dependent upon her lore, she seems to be high in that hierarchy.
It seems like a primary status. Prophecy and fate seems very important for anything else that would be deemed a god, right?
Lotus would love her. Give, you know, plus or minus a few tentacles.
right. Yeah, it's the combination of Hermaeus Mora and the new Daedric Prince that they've released in this new update for ESO. So both prophecy, like basically knowledge, and then fate together. Okay, so who else is there?
So there's Janiri, goddess of seasons, storms, and agriculture. Now, this is a god I actually cannot remember learning about in the lore. I don't doubt it, because the curators are vastly more intelligent about the lore than I am. It's also not one person. You know, Janiri apparently has rule over farms and the weather.
This is the agriculture god. This is every ancient society had an agriculture god or some sort of deity or spirit or something that was over that. So yeah, that makes sense.
And keep in mind, you know, each one of these gods is a representation of the help that they got from the Protheans.
Right.
And we learn from Javik that, and this might actually be the source of it in Mass Effect 3. We learn from Javik that the Protheans were the ones who taught the Asari agriculture, mm-hmm. which is, you know, the bedrock of civilizations.
Right. Absolutely. Okay. So what's next?
There's Kralla, a demon of misfortune.
So this is like the trickster god. This is the Loki.
This is the Clavicus Vial of another Elder Scrolls reference.
Yeah.
But Kralla, not a lot of information on the wiki for Kralla. And I frankly don't remember learning about Kralla at all during the games. But there's also an Artemis-type god, Corinth, the goddess of war and hunting, mm-hmm. who is like a combination of Artemis and Athena.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, or Athena, Athame, sounds very familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Ancient Greek republics worshipping Athame, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, all of these words seem like they're Greek-derived.
A lot of them ending in A, you know, like another one, Tukria, a legendary Asari archer. Okay, archer, come on. dating back to Thessia's Iron Age.
Mm-hmm.
A very, very Greco-Roman here.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's also a god of death, goddess of death, I should say. Pyres or Pyres. Pyres? I don't know.
Pyres?
another one I don't remember learning about in the games, but this is apparently, you know, legit lore. Pyres? I don't know. Goddess of death and someone who guides spirits on their final journey. Okay, that's a concept that's very old, right? You know, as mm-hmm. old as ancient Egyptian mythology, Greek mythology, Norse mythology.
Yeah.
Almost every belief system that believed in an afterlife had a guide of spirits.
You know, like the boatman crossing on the river Styx. Yeah, the same kind of thing, right?
Yes. Who's also referenced in Mass Effect, the Charon Mass Relay.
Mm-hmm.
So there's also Tevura, the goddess of love, sex, travel, and law.
Okay, that's how I always like to mix those four things.
Sounds like a very interesting life, honestly. God, love, sex, travel, and law. I think that sounds like a rich lawyer Instagram influencer.
This is a lawyer who spends like half of their time traveling and going on these like exotic romps because they're wealthy enough to do it.
So yeah, those are just a few of the extra gods. So this topic is especially interesting, right? If you bring Javik, and this is kind of why you have to bring Javik along with Liara to Thessia in Mass Effect 3. So you walk in to this highly sacred temple, the Temple of Athene. Again, sounds a lot like Athena. Some of the architecture looks very Greco-Roman. And in front of you are all of these artifacts that you can spur dialogue from. So we have a clip here, we can play it.
Could this be the artifact?
I don't think so. It's the goddess Athame's sword. Myths say she wielded it against the jealous gods who threatened our ancestors.
They were a race called the Ouroboros. Thessia had vast resources. We protected you from them.
You protected? But then Athame...
There is more to your history than you know, Asari.
What's this?
The goddess Athame's shield. Legends say she used it to protect Thessia when the heavens grew angry. Our ancestors were probably misinterpreting a meteor shower.
It was an asteroid strike. We deflected it.
Are you actually suggesting that the Protheans intervened in our past?
It's more than a suggestion. I find it strange your scientists would abandon their own planet.
They wouldn't.
What about this one?
A page from one of our earliest religious texts, the Athame Codex. I doubt this is it. It describes Lucin, Athame's guide who taught our ancestors about the stars.
Your species was deemed to have potential. Pity you didn't live up to it.
I love how matter-of-fact Javik is.
Yeah. The edge. Man, Javik, you better be careful not to cut yourself on all that edge. Pity you didn't live up to it. Man, that's so... Wouldn't you feel, like, sad and disappointed if someone said that to you about your entire race?
Yeah. Yeah, like, oh, God, okay. All right.
Yeah. But it also tells us that they were uplifting them for a reason, right? And, of course, Javik elaborates a little bit on that in Mass Effect. But I wanted to play that clip to just kind of explain that each one of those artifacts, each time that she's bringing up something about Asari mythology, perhaps the spirituality that spawned from that, can really be traced back to the Protheans.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
the Temple of Athame, we find out by the end of that mission, is a hidden Prothean beacon with a ton of knowledge that not only was kept hidden from the other races, but even Asari themselves. Mm-hmm. And the government hoarded this knowledge and then used it to their advantage. Kind of calls into question all of the previous accomplishments that they've had, hasn't it?
Right, right. But also feels very real, you know, because knowledge is power. And
knowing is half the battle.
G.I. Joe. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. That's our episode. This has been fun. This is a really interesting take on Thessia and all the different dynamics and how it does or doesn't make sense. It's all very complex, but I hope you've enjoyed the kind of, I don't know, thought experiment that we went on for this conversation. I thought it was enjoyable.
Yeah, I have had a ton of fun. You know, Thessia is such an interesting planet because it is the galactic seat of power, if you don't consider the Citadel Council, you know.
Sure.
It is the most powerful planet, apparently, in the Milky Way. And yet, there's so many of these competing ideas and realities about it that some parts are like a paradox, you know, the fast technological advancement, and yet the slow cultural advancement.
Right, right.
Things like that, you know, and it's utopic, apparently, for a reason. It was designed to be that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting stuff. I'd love, if you have any other thoughts, if there's things that we missed or perspectives that you want to share, please jump into the Discord and share your thoughts and things like that. Sam, you have anything else you want to share before we head out?
Yeah, of course. I am still streaming my personal canon playthrough of Mass Effect 3. Streaming that on Saturdays on Twitch. I skipped this past week doing my midweek Fallout stream, just getting a little overwhelmed with work right now. But I am going to be picking that back up, so I'm going to be doing two streams, Fallout, my Enclave Outcast roleplay, where I've downloaded a very expansive Enclave mod that I've been playing with, and a ton of other mods that I've been playing with in Mass Effect. I've also been experimenting with the new Starfield mods, and I've been considering, playing a playthrough of Starfield on stream now that I've already completed the game. I already know what the stories are like. You know, I'm not going to miss out on anything by trying to interact with chat. And I've been thinking about, you know, you brought it up to me, maybe I should make a Shepard in Starfield.
Yeah, Shepard gets pulled into a different universe, and then you make decisions based on what your, like, canon Shepard would do in the situation. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
That could be fun.
Maybe I should do Neutral Shepard.
Neutral Shepard? You try to be Neutral Shepard in Starfield?
Neutral Shepard in Starfield, and he just wants to go home, back to his universe.
I just need to find the unity to get back to my own universe. Oh, man, that'd be great.
Please let me go home.
That'd be great. Yeah. Well, just another reminder, we're taking next week off. I'm on vacation with the family, and Sam's got some other stuff going on. But we'll be back in 2 weeks with our patrons. The patron chat is coming up. That's two Fridays from us recording this right now on the 28th. So we'll see you, our patrons, and you have time to sign up if you'd like to join us. And if you are looking for other content, robotsradio.net has the rest of my podcasts and a bunch of other podcasts from other people on the network. Lots of cool stuff. So go check it all out. Thanks for being here, everybody, and have a wonderful rest of your week. And I don't have a warning. I guess be careful about cultural and scientific and political advancement not moving at the same speed. Like, what,
you know what I think the lesson is here? Practice humility, because you never know where your advantages came from.
There you go. Yeah, your past is probably more complex than you remember or know or will ever find out. Have a wonderful week. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for tuning in to the Mass Effect Lorecast. We'd love to hear your opinion and thoughts on the lore of Mass Effect. Reach out to us on Twitter at Mass Effect Cast, or check out the Robots Radio Discord. Also, you can send us an email at masseffectlorecast@gmail.com.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at tanger.com.